Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm going to skip the mic, I think. We got a nice, intimate audience. This is intended to be an interactive presentation. The topic is forming and leading expert teams. I have a cheat sheet, I guess.
Here we go. So please fill these out when we're done. I'll remind you again before we're done.
So a couple questions about the audience. How many folks here are managing a function? Anybody? Anybody? All right. Well. How many folks are a project leader or manager? Probably most everybody. All right. How many are individual contributors or experts? Okay. How many folks have viewed their background as engineering? Okay. How many are in sales and marketing? Probably. Okay. That's lone wolf, no club. All right. Finance and operations. Anybody? All right. There we go. And executive management. Overhead. Okay, great. I'm sorry. how many folks are consultant, freelance, solo? All right. How many are in a startup, which we'll just define as a small firm of, let's say, 2 to 15 people? Okay. How many are in firms that are medium-sized, maybe 16 to 200? Okay, and how many are in large firms? Okay. That helps quite a bit, actually. Okay. So we've got three broad topics: how to spot an expert, how to form a team of experts, and then how to kind of blend expertise as a part of the team decision-making process. So my vote is that you can make high-quality judgments in a small amount of time from a small amount of data. And that's what is the marker, or the hallmark, of an expert. They understand what questions to ask. They understand what's missing. A lot of people can look at a situation or a product or a problem and say, here's how to make it better, here's how to improve it. Experts can figure out what doesn't fit and what's missing. And finally, they're able to predict outcomes from the decision. They're able to predict the logical consequences of the decision. They use that actually as a part of the deliberate practice to get better. As I threatened, this will be interactive. Questions for the audience. How do people recognize experts? Should anybody want to take a shot at it? Please.
They ask the right questions.
All right. Ask the right questions.
I recognize an expert because they become a go-to person.
So they give you good information?
They give you good information.
Anybody else? Some of the more experienced members of our crowd here? Told me that I wouldn't be able to shut people up. This looks more like an oil painting.
They're always the first to reject my meeting invites.
I see. There we go. That's probably a good partner. Yes. So they're good judges of character. Yes.
They often have long tenured company, 15, 20 years more than that.
There's evidence, actually, that it takes about 10 or 15 years to become an expert. There's a psychologist, Erickson, at the University of Florida. Yes, sir.
When you get them in a meeting, you can immediately point them out by how everybody else reacts around them.
That's good. So they're recognized. Yes, sir.
I was going to say they participate and they know many of the answers.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. I ask around.
There you go. Social navigation. Yes, sir.
I think most of the time if they are room changers, so they come in, they advise you on something, and that just changes the game.
Oh, that's good. They understand how to change the game. All right. Anybody else? No? Going once. Okay, so what's the problem of, as we've talked about, individual expertise? A lot of evidence that it takes more than a decade to accumulate this. You've got to see a lot of patterns. You've got to see a lot of situations. Experts don't just follow recipes or understand one method or the variations of one method. They have a lot of ways of getting things done, right? The challenge is a lot of times this competence is unconscious. They've moved beyond, right, being able necessarily to explicitly give you rules. It's not often available to introspection. Right? Can be, but often they can ask questions. When confronted with a situation, that will provoke an answer, but they can't necessarily write it down or to explain in advance. This leads to a phenomenon we call "I'll know it when I see it." Right?
I got involved with a project in about 2004 where people were setting up a series of medical clinics in Vietnam to do pap smears. And the rate of cervical cancer in Vietnam is about 4x the U.S. And it was a very strange thing that happens when experienced pathologists read a pap smear, is that things that are clearly cancerous are pretty straightforward, and they teach that in medical school. But there's a whole bunch of things that are kind of in the middle. And it's those that are actually the most valuable. It's catching it right as it's precancerous, as opposed to it's clearly progressed to stage 2 or stage 3. And that's what kind of kicked off what ultimately became this talk, was I began to think that expertise is different from craft labor or clerical labor. Right, if you have 4 guys digging a ditch, you can divide the section up into 4 pieces. They can each dig, and you're good. Right? You put 4 people trying to solve a puzzle, it doesn't necessarily go 4 times as fast. Right? Now, if you look at a choir, the choir is able to create sounds, create music that an individual soloist can't perform. Right? So there are things that groups can do that individuals can't. But there's this odd challenge with expertise that it's not normally amenable to a divide and conquer approach, right? And so when we're planning work breakdown, we're planning how to leverage expertise. A lot of the techniques we use for regular work don't work, right? So we'll pick an engineer first, and then we'll. Ordinarily, you see somebody start off gathering facts, observations, opinions, right? Looking for symptoms, right? So as an engineer, we want to know what's the facts, what are the measurements, what's the data, what's going on, what's the customer telling us, right? Sometimes we ship products that haven't worked. How many people have shipped a product that didn't work all the time? So you're then going to form a hypothesis, and actually you're probably going to form multiple hypotheses. Right? You're not going to just guess at one thing. You're going to have a whole cluster of things you're going to try and rule out, typically in parallel, right? You're going to determine what's the differential between these various hypotheses, right? What tests can we run to rule things out, rule things in? You're typically walking some kind of fault tree to confirm or disconfirm what's going on, right? Now, sometimes you can get from an expert this map or this plan, right? We'll confront with a particular problem and say, look, there might be 3 things going on here. Let's do this. If it's not that, let's do that, right? Often they'll be able to propose a particular solution once they've achieved some node in that tree. At which point, they can say, look, here's why I think this is the right way to go. Now, you can tell you've got a real plan when everyone is vaguely unsatisfied. Right? There's no such thing as a real plan. Everybody's delighted. Right? It's not in the real world. And finally, the other hallmark, in my opinion, of expertise is they actually track the outcome to their prediction, and they get better at making the predictions. It's not enough that they told you 3 months ago it was going to happen. They go back and check. And so that's either a lesson learned process, a retrospective process, there's various names for this, right? Army calls it after action. So I'll go through this for the physician as well. It's much the same. We use this when we talk to startups because they expect customers to tell them what to do. When we say it's more like a doctor, the customer can give you symptoms, they can't give you specs, right? It's up to you to navigate from the symptoms, coming up with a kind of a diagnosis or root cause of what the problem is, to make sure you've actually zeroed in on what the problem is, right? Why it's this and not that, or not this other thing. Offer a prescription, which is a course of action, right? And with every prescription, you should have a prognosis, right? So when you go to the doctor and you say this or that, they say, okay, this should clear up in 7 days. If 10 days from now it hasn't, please call me, right? And a really good doctor will actually call you in 10 days and say, hey, what happened, right? My son had his wisdom teeth pulled out about 3 months ago. Doctor called 2 times. How's he doing? What's going on? He didn't wait for me to say, hey, there's some problem. I got worked out fine. But again, it's the same example applied to a physician instead of an engineer. And I think these 6 steps, broadly, are what experts do. The other challenge with solving hard problems is the challenge of personal mastery, because most problems have an emotional content as well. Most problems have things that trigger emotional blind spots in you or in the team, right? And so what you see over time is that experts are able to engage in this self-debugging process, understand, oh, I've got a, this is a blind spot for me, I've got to work on this, right? Often, the reason why problems recur is not because of a technical reason, but because of some psychological or emotional challenges involved with solving that problem, right? And again, just to hammer it home, people get good at predicting outcomes and follow-up, and this normally takes about 10,000 hours. Now, I think there's some variation on that. The other hallmark of expertise is a certain amount of confidence. They approach the problem as if they can solve it. Virgil's got this great quote from, you know, 2,500 years ago. They can because they think they can. Right? It's, in fact, it's that confidence that allows them to move forward and try this.
Question.
Yes.
On your first bullet, while we're talking about the emotional aspect, you said the emotional aspect, because they were perhaps involved in it before, they don't want to find an error, or is it just a general emotional aspect of being human?
So I think it's part of being human. I think that we have certain built-in biases, yes. and to get above a certain level of expertise, you've got to overcome your own blind spots, and that's not purely a technical problem. Right, so with chess masters, some people are very good on the offense. They don't like to defend, but to be a good chess master, you've got to be able to do both. Right? You see this in a lot of fields where you've got to be able to move into different operating modes depending upon what the situation requires. Your strength may be one way, but you've got to shift context. Question?
So a lot of this, you just mentioned chess. I know medicine's this way too. Is a lot of this kind of a function of just being able to recognize patterns?
I mean, a lot of it is patterns. A lot of it.
You've seen this or something like this many times before. You can zero in quickly. Chess masters don't think moving forward. They've just seen every pattern possible for years and years. And
they've done tests, right, where they show arrangements of chess pieces on a board to novices and chess masters, and then they test their recall. And it turns out the chess masters are good at recalling positions that occur naturally in the game, and no better than novices for random collections of pieces. So they've somehow encoded the information in a way that's a part of the natural evolution of the game, or of a game. Right? So I think it's more than just pure pattern recognition. It's not like a neural network, right? I think they're building models of how the situation typically unfolds and the natural variances around that.
Thank you, Clark.
So, to recap, small amounts of data, not much time, that's when you need an expert. They can ask the right additional questions and give you a quality decision. To your point, they're able to recognize patterns from a few details, right? My niece, about 20 years ago now, she was 18 months old, she had a cold, and my sister-in-law was, well, I don't know if I want to take her in or not. It's been going on about 2-3 days, runny nose. So finally she took her into the doctor. The doctor puts a stethoscope on her and says, she's going to the ER right now. And she was actually in heart failure. What he heard was a small amount of fluid in a little 18-month-old child. And he goes, this is anomalous, but this symptom means something really bad is going on. Right? This is not something that bears watchful waiting. Again, predict results, track outcomes. Now, teams can also do this at a team level. There's a fair amount of evidence. Akoff calls this the decision record model. There's other names for it. If when you make a decision, you force everybody to write down what they think the reasons are they made the decision and the likely consequences, take those away somewhere, seal them up, bring them back 3, 6, 9 months later, you'll overcome this cognitive dissonance model where people think they were in favor of whatever worked or didn't. Right?
Very good. That's a good trick.
Akoff's got that a couple places, and there's other variations of that as well. So that can also work for teams. For individuals, it also works quite well. We kind of covered how to spot an expert. What do you do when the problem is bigger than one person? Right. Now you need a team. These days, most of the challenging problems are kind of interstitial. They occur at the intersection of 2 or 3 disciplines, right? And so you've got to find a way to get different people that don't necessarily speak the same language to somehow make, you know, 1 plus 1 equals 3 as opposed to 1.1 equals 1, 1 plus 1 equals 1.1, right? So how do we stack expertise, right? The first point is to get agreement on a shared mission. So we've already said that a lot of these experts are blessed with self-confidence. They feel a high degree of self-sufficiency. How do you get these people to collaborate? You've got to pick a problem which they know they can't solve on their own. They know they're going to have to work with other people. You need to put in place metrics for measuring that progress. You need to put in place mechanisms, both practices and tools, to facilitate shared situational awareness. Where are we? What's happened? Where have we come from? That enables each member of the team to link their plan of action to the ultimate goals the team is trying to achieve. So, Schonk came up with this about 25 years ago. A lot of people start to debug team problems at their relationship level. So if people aren't getting along, let's work on the relationship issues, right? For the most part, the challenge is, do we have alignment on the goals? Do we have an understanding of what roles people are going to play to achieve those goals? Do we have a rough agreement on the process? At that point, you can start to tackle the relationships. Question?
Yeah, when you get teams of experts together, have you ever seen situations where they start evaluating the expertise of the others? And then
often the most important problem is who's the smartest guy around the table? Who's got the biggest brain? Right? Yes.
They start second guessing, and then that's can be an issue right there.
So often that means you haven't put a problem that's on the table that requires them to collaborate.
Well, they'll collaborate, but they the key expert probably doesn't think that the information the other experts are bringing to the table is, I guess, say, thought through enough, or they're that qualified as he is to go into it.
Right, and so that six-item checklist is one way to go back and say, can we agree on what the facts are? Can you explain your hypothesis or your suggestion for root cause? Can you explain your differentials, why you believe it's this and not that, right? Can we run some experiments where you predict some near-term outcomes to say, are we in this world or that world, right? So you've got to take it step by step, right? A lot of the more interesting problems involve exploration of a possibility space of some sort. Making a new product is a box of Legos you can assemble, you know, a million ways, right? So what's the possibility we're trying to reach? I'll get a little more on that in a minute. I'll come back to that. The other thing about relationships is that not every disagreement is actually a dispute or a personality conflict. There are a lot of natural dilemmas, a lot of healthy dilemmas that go into effective teams. You've got somebody worried about quality, somebody worried about cost, somebody worried about performance. They're going to be in tension with each other. And the challenge of the team is, how do we find solutions that make progress on multiple axes? So there's a distinction between a dilemma, which is actually healthy, and a dispute over territory or prestige or who's got the biggest brain, which is less healthy. How many people have been in a two-pizza meeting? You've got 6 to 12 people around the table and two pizzas. This is Silicon Valley, no? Bigger teams, everybody's in bigger teams. 12 pizza teams, all right. So even in this size, right, which is kind of where social process still works, 6 to 12 people, you're going to need different experts to get a product out. You may need somebody that understands power, somebody that understands mechanical, somebody that understands software. Good luck with that. And they're trying to make trade-offs around cost, performance, development time, and risk to get to some outcome. The difference between watching an individual expert trying to get to a decision are two barriers that you introduce when you've got multiple people trying to collaborate is your point, is trust. Can we get to some level of shared respect, shared trust, right? Typically around alignment around goals. And your behavior is predictable to me at some level. And then can we get some level of shared situational awareness? Can we agree on how the world works at least? Can we agree on where we are on the map, right? And what we're going to try next? So normally,
to maintain shared situational awareness, you need two things. You need ongoing active communication amongst team members, which if you're solving the problem on your own, this is a whole new problem now, right? A lot of people tend to be introverted. They don't want to have to explain all their thinking. They just want to, here's the answer, right? But now you've got to explain your thinking because somebody else may have the answer, not you, or they may be able to improve upon it. And secondly, normally requires tools to facilitate shared memory, whether this is a whiteboard, a flip chart, a wiki, whatever. So my question for the audience is, what techniques do you use as project managers to foster active communication?
SharePoint, Basecamp, some place where many multiple people have access to the same.
How many people use SharePoint? Is that curious? All right. How many people using Basecamp? All right. How many people using something else?
Box.
Dropbox. Anybody using Dropbox? A small one out there. Dropbox. Other ones?
Google Drive,
there we go. FTP with lipstick. Other tools you found useful, either for facilitating community. Anybody using Yammer? Okay.
Oh, these two Skype all the time.
Skype, there we go, Skype. Phone calls got a lot cheaper. Somebody told me I should put Skype on a business card about 8 years ago, and I ignored it, so I was mistaken.
Things that are slightly different, like mind mapping.
There we go. That's a good one. So a mind map is an alternate representation of what's going on, and I can look at your mind map and add to it.
Yeah.
How many people use mind maps? Interesting.
Wiki is something.
Wikis, there we go. Other tools you're using as project managers? Around the shared memory or the active communication?
Sometimes it's Facebook or
Baseball.
Oh,
there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Recap. So, to get experts to collaborate, you need a problem that's hard enough that they realize that they can't do it alone, right? When you look at Watson and Crick, two people blessed with fairly significant egos, able to collaborate over a number of years because they were unlocking DNA. Right? Big problem. Right? The Shunt model I find very useful. Let's make sure we understand what the goals are, what roles are people going to play, what processes we're going to follow, then worry about the interpersonal issues. Right? And finally, think about how you foster shared situational awareness, what practices, what tools are going to put in place to foster active communication and shared group memory, common team memory. Okay, we've got the team together. Now, yes, go ahead.
I'm not sure if this is what you another example, but we use a World Cafe.
Oh, cool.
I do that kind of thing. It fosters communication.
So it's got a persistent, like a forum. It's got persistent, there's persistent posts, and you kind of look back, and it's searchable, right?
I mean, if we're physically in one location, then we'll find a World Cafe as a way to collect ideas around certain problems.
Can you store it?
No, I mean, that at the end, we archive it on iShare or something, but this is more, not brainstorming, but...
You mean we have tables and people rotate?
Yes,
oh, okay. Well, it's
yes,
really like a snake or a thread, right? So you have,
yeah.
So everybody gets to talk to everybody else in the context of a small group.
Yes.
That's a very good one, yes. I thought you meant the online. Yes, sir.
Question, once you've established this and you've got your expert team, your team of experts working, do you find out over a certain time period they will lapse into maybe these personality issues, or do you have to go back and readdress the goals and objectives at a certain time period? Because
so is it it's not box Jenkins, it's... So forming, storming, norming, performing, that's a recognized sequence,
yeah.
Right? So normally the arguments come more in the beginning until there's agreement on norms.
Okay.
There still may be a low-intensity amount of conflict that you never get rid of, right? The trick is they have to have some feeling of interdependency. So you can tell you're on a team because you need the other people to get the job done. Right? When that goes away, the team goes away.
So ordinarily, when you're looking at a team decision, you're facing trade-offs or constraints around your budget, how much time you have, what's the outcome, the performance, the figure of merit, however you want to put it, that the project or the product is trying to achieve, and how much risk are you going to take to achieve those results or to spend budget against mitigating. So one example, if you look at board design, we'll come back to the two pizza product team, right? You've got a whole bunch of disciplines, right? So in the beginning, it was pretty easy. You had maybe an analog designer, maybe you got a new analog or digital. Then these more complex parts started to show up. You have one guy be the ASIC guy. Then at some point, chaos ensued and software was embedded. Now that started to become important. Timing kind of crept up from kilohertz to megahertz to gigahertz. All kinds of new problems came out of the woodwork. Products couldn't ship. And finally, we're coming to the end of forced air convection as a viable cooling technology. So the thermal guy, who has been kind of the handmaiden of the team, is now driving the bus. And that's a very interesting switch. So here, you've got an example where, let's say historically, 5 or 10 years ago, the cooling problem was not really a constraint. Now it is almost always the dominant factor. Certainly anything that's portable, anything that's in a machine room or a data center, right? And we're going back to liquid. There's no way around it. And that is an entire kind of phase transition into how you cool things. That's going to completely redo things. Each of these domains normally needs its own expert. Like the guy that's good at software typically knows very little about thermal. And they need the ability to negotiate trade-offs. So what can you do? What can you do to get these people together and to communicate, right? And the typical problem is I, as the expert, am speaking in a representation or a domain-specific language that I understand very well, that I'm comfortable with, and if you're not a part of my domain, good luck, right? So one example is you may have the software folks come to you with a written software spec and say, what do you think? Have we overlooked anything? Should we go do this or not? Right? If you actually force them to build a mock-up, to build a UI, to build a simulation of what that looks like, a whole bunch of people can comment on it. Not many people can actually read code specifications that aren't software people and come to a reasonable opinion. We had a similar problem. Mechanical guys would show up with an isometric drawing. Now, you go into mechanical engineering because you're typically blessed with pretty good 3D visualization skills. You can see a 2.5D drawing and visualize the box. It's just obvious, right? A lot of people don't have those skills. And so they look at a drawing and see a lot of lines. So we were building these boxes that had all these problems. It's like, hey, let's go spend $100 to build a cardboard model. We'll lose a week, but we won't spin the sheet metal once, right? So think about how you can force each domain to come up with a representation that's more universally understood. It may not capture everything that their domain-specific representation will, but it should capture enough to facilitate more effective trade-offs. Other people tried this? How do you? You've got 2 or 3 experts in different domains. How do you get them to kind of come to some working arrangement?
Mock-ups are the best way to overcome some of the barriers and facilitate communication.
And, sometimes simple prototypes.
And sometimes have even gained respect for one another because you can better understand the limitations, even if it's only cardboard.
I've said, I didn't think of that. That's a good point.
Yeah.
The third time that the board drill holes didn't line up with the sheet metal, it's like, hey, we got a problem.
Yeah.
This is getting really expensive. Okay, question for the audience. Crises. This is where experts are normally at their most valuable. So think about in your last project a crisis that occurred, and think about a kind of a quick summary. Who was around the table? What constraints were the most important? What constraints were the least important? Anybody want to volunteer a anecdote?
Software problem. We had the business expert.
Oh, that's in charge of bullshit.
Yeah. And we had the software developer expert and then the QA expert.
Ooh.
Because it was like QA. You know, so you have all the experts around the table, and of course, it's my way. I'm right. And then you have to get back into what's real versus what are we doing and what's real and what's really shippable. So, yeah.
There's a natural tension between the QA guy and the designer, right?
Well, the business person and the QA people, and they're all three of them.
Right. They're all healthily.
Yeah, because, yeah, it's like, what are you testing? It's like, and then that's not real world, or, you know, are you testing something that's totally out of sync with reality, or... And then the business guy says, we must have it this, even though we've never seen it before in our life. We never expect to see it, but we have to have it anyway. So, yeah.
Anybody else have an example of banging guys together? Please.
I had a global rollout of finance software, and people all over the world were supposed to do all of the sound testing. And one of my testers, an IT guy, in Asia, said, well, he didn't want to disturb the people in England, so he tested it for them, not realizing that he had the IT version. So the bugs weren't going to show up like they were for the users. And the users came into that conversation and said, well, you were never asking us in the first place. So you didn't ask us if we wanted help. You know, you were being polite. So we had the tension between someone who is trying to, we sincerely thought they were trying to do a nice thing, for a user who understood what the difference was between a user interface and the developer's machine, right?
So that's a good point. The customer is always an expert as well.
Yes.
In their own problem. Yes.
What things are the most important, those are the ones that are the most valued to the customer. Right. I mean, always.
What they pay for. There you might actually need the business guy to say, what are they actually going to pay for? Because they may express a lot of opinions, but what are they actually going to pay for?
One.
Or not pay for. Or pay to avoid.
Yes.
So, yeah, we have a client. We're working with a subsidiary of a larger firm. And the major, or the parent, had a very significant customer as part of their revenue base. And all of a sudden, one day they get this RFP due in 2 weeks to rebid the entire business, which was about 50% of their revenue, which was kind of like an electric shock. What they realized, so we got called in for this 2 week fire drill. You're working every day, 14 hours a day, kind of Saturday, Sunday, you know, trying to get some response out. And what we realized is that the team had lost contact with what was actually happening in the account. The account team was in place, and the people they'd been talking to were in place, but the guys running the show now was a whole new crew, and they didn't like us.
Oh.
And it was. It was a reminder to me, you've always got to get on the ground. You've got to get in there. You've got to be talking to what's going on, whether it's in the lab, in the customer, in the field, whatever. Right? You sit around the table and we theorize about what's going on. At some point, you've got to, you know, get in your car, get in a jet, whatever. That actually does not have a happy ending. So that was interesting. How many people have been on a team that's lost touch with the facts on the ground? Yeah. You ever have it with a dashboard you're steering to may not be actually the compass for the customer value, you know? Maybe it's historical. Historically, they've always wanted this, right? You wonder when they came out with the Wii. People go, what is this whole new thing? How could you design this thing that's got accelerometers in it? This is not what should be in a video game. It's like totally changed the value proposition. So my question is, for somebody's in a situation, at what point did you realize that the map and the territory had departed substantially from each other, and what did you do to address it? What, do you have a story about this? Or?
That's a typical problem when we all face. Project that should have been canceled and wasn't.
Ah.
You need a process in place to review the project on an ongoing basis. Does it still match the market that you're building it?
You know,
I have found for some reason that Project Birth Control is difficult, and euthanasia is almost impossible. I've never worked anywhere where they kill projects. When I was at Cisco, we developed a product for quite a bit of money. I don't know. Let's say half a billion dollars. We determined after we had built it that the total worldwide demand was going to be about 100 units.
Yeah.
And we calculated, and these boxes cost, I don't know, $250,000. We calculated it would be cheaper for us to buy back the units than face the logistical supply chain and the parts tail for 5 years. Of course, they couldn't do it because that would be to admit you'd screwed up.
Yeah.
It's like, we'll buy that box back, we'll sell you the competitor's box, and we'll save money. But true story. Other people, how do you tell when you suddenly, you're like, you're looking at the map and you realize, oh, this is not Illinois, this is Wisconsin.
Well, what's interesting is that we have experienced the customer all of a sudden started pulling back communication. Didn't have as much time to brainstorm with you because they felt you were going down a completely different path, not to meet their objectives. And so as a result, when they started to be not as accessible, we had to step back and say, you know, what's the reason behind it? And when you got into the account, you figured out, well, they thought we were off on a different tangent altogether, not listening to them.
We just had a meeting this afternoon with a client where they've been working for a while to get their system installed. The clients, their end customer signed the contract. Got an email Friday afternoon, said, really sorry, but we're going to cancel this. We don't want this anymore. So people are going, well, we should, you know, get the lawyers, let's do this, let's do that. It's like, why don't we figure out why they're saying that first?
Yeah.
But we're still talking. Let's figure out how we screwed up. Yes, sir.
In one case that I can think of, the rumors that were surrounding the project, the informal communication was not matching what was in the formal aspect in the dashboard, which required insinuating myself to the project manager's working for me, insinuating myself into the project, and found that executives were actually the source of that information. It wasn't quite matching up.
So are rumors always true?
No, they are. That's why I have to go in there and figure out whether it is or not. In this case, it was a project manager who was had something else going on in his life, was paying less and less attention to what was going on, and more of the work was being pushed over to the lead technical guy.
So you have to be very careful when you're framing a problem to the expert. If you're showing him the wrong map of the problem, the answer he's going to give you is probably not going to work. The team is not going to break through because they've lost contact with the ground.
You know, that begs another question. How many times when you've had executives involved in communication with the account that it's improved or caused issues? I've had this problem where, you know, when we got our executive involvement, he was real happy to be there talking to real customers versus hypothetical. But the list of requirements he came back with sent us down a rabbit hole for a long time. And then we re-engaged with them again on a one-on-one level. We were able to clarify this. Has anybody else experienced that?
Never let an executive go alone.
Well, yeah. You have to prime them really, really well as to what they can say and tell them they can't promise anything else.
Review their charts ahead of time.
Yeah.
It's also
careful.
It's also what you tell the sales force.
Yeah.
Because they'll sell it. So another hallmark of expertise is that an expert knows a lot of ways of doing things. So most of us can follow a recipe, right? What if I'm out of tomato sauce? What do I do now? Right? A journeyman knows a method and the common variations of it. But an expert knows many ways because, as we discussed, they've got a mental model of the situation. They're actually able to mentally simulate the situation at some level of accuracy. And they understand how to defer decisions until deferring a decision is, in fact, a decision. Right? So you can make decisions too early. Right? In the situation, if it's not required, you're going to learn more, maybe you should defer.
they tend to defer things that trigger irreversible changes. Right? Threatening a lawsuit, probably you should do that later on. Right? Those of you, if you want to test the strength of your marriage, don't say, let's go see other people. That creates a kind of an irreversible sensation. Right? It's one way to test, but it's not a good test. What you normally see is you'll pick the what's called the old man way. You'll get started on the slow, sure, expensive path, just so you've got that one in the bag, and then figure out can we optimize that, or is that what we're stuck with? But at least let's pick a way to solve this. We know it's going to work, and we can upgrade it as we go.
What about the one that says I start with the simplest fix and then work towards complexity?
Well, the simplest fix that you believe is going to actually address the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Normally what happens is people go, well, that probably won't happen, so let's not include that in the fix. Let's just solve this third of the problem, and the rest of it we probably ignore and go away. I agree. So you want the simplest fix that'll work. Question? No? So, recap. For team decision making, you need to come to a common language for how you're going to express things. This may be able to translate things into common risk metrics, common budget metrics, common schedule metrics, other ways that other people, the expertise you've got can be brought to bear on the conversation. Right? If we're going to talk about things that only you can discuss, then that's just a way for you to cleverly get your way. Right? If you can't explain it to me as a layman, so I have... One of my friends is one of the guys that founded Cisco, and he said he's got a new job. He goes around to teams that are in trouble and tries to figure out what's going on. Because the problem is that he's not quite at the forefront of technology the way he was, let's say, 20 years ago, right? But he's got this very simple test. He'll ask simple questions. And if the expert can't give him simple answers, then that guy doesn't actually understand what's going on. It doesn't matter what he's saying. It means that there's a real problem. And then he knows he's got to dig in and get other guys and knockheads and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that simple language is actually a reasonable test. When you're making these major decisions to your simple fix, right? Mm-hmm. The question is, how do we tell? So the rule when you're in an airplane approaching a mountain is as you get closer, if you're seeing more of the mountain, you've got a problem. Right? As you get closer, you should be seeing less and less of the mountain. Right? If the mountain is filling the windshield, you're not going to get over the mountain. So the question is, we're on a course of action. How will we tell if it's working? Right? And when will we know, right? My brother is a rocket scientist, a real one. Now he's kind of in the package delivery business where things need to land very close to where they've got to get. So they have a thing called the range safety officer, right? So they've got this parameter, this kind of this area, that if the launch gets outside of that parameter, then you have to blow it up. Right? That's what that guy does. He's got a button. So when you plot the anticipated course of the payload, you don't want it to get really close to where that line is, right? So they planned a launch of a satellite that was $200 million. When they planned the launch to save money, they had to kind of kiss the edge of that window, right? Cheapest way to go. So the range safety guy, young guy, he's looking, he's going, it's going to cross. He pushes the button, right? So you may not want to make decisions where the gap between when you know it's not working and when things start to go really bad is wide, right? And then finally, as you make the decision, conduct a pre-mortem. Figure out what we're going to do if this doesn't work. Yeah. What's the most likely reason it won't work? And what are we going to do about it now? Because right now, we're at least all talking to each other, right? Later on, things are going more sideways, then you're into this, you know, a little more heat than light. So, room full of project managers. I'm sure you all have backup plans for what you're doing.
Right? Risk analysis.
Risk analysis, of course. Plan B, plan C. So, one of the things that we actually tell the startups is you have to plan for unexpected success, which is probably less true in big companies, but startups actually stumble across this sometimes. Right? You never know. We had a team that was giving demos, and we stressed to them, you know, We're going to ask for 20 minutes, and at the end of 20 minutes, if they're not excited, we're just going to get up and leave, because that way we can come back later on. Because we said we'd take 20 minutes, we didn't waste your time. In Silicon Valley, one of the biggest sins is you waste somebody's time, they can't get back on their calendar, right? So in about 18 minutes, they go, this is great, how can we install this, how can we get going? No one's ever said that. New rule. We always plan for what happens when the client says yes. Right? But you get used to the client. You get really good at saying, oh, that's okay. You're shutting your, turning your thing off. It's okay. No, we really want to buy it. So we always force people to actually plan the implementation all the way out. Plan for unexpected success. When you draw a plan for a new product, right, there's a line. So big companies, again, probably hard. There's probably a line where you go, if you're below this line, kill it. Now, at least draw that plan. They may not pull the trigger. Right? Then you've got kind of nominal success and the nominal sequels. What do? There should be another line which says, if we're above this line, we actually went, you know, drilling for oil and found uranium. Let's do more. Right? So anybody want to talk about backup plans or a good way to develop a plan B? It must be like a PM. There's a whole book of this stuff, probably. Yes. See, I'm in a long room. You guys have got this all figured out. I'm just a marketing guy. Okay, well, more about us. Oh, so there we go. So, we've covered all three. So, high-level recap. Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them. 3 points, but with maybe more bullets than they deserve. One test for an expert is, given limited data in a short amount of time, they can still arrive at a quality decision, and they can tell you what's missing. Second test, they engage in deliberate practice. They care about the outcomes, and they go and they grab them, and they get better at what they're doing. Right? They're raising the bar on themselves. Right? Team of experts requires a challenge that's big enough to foster collaboration. You can't, you know, don't go out to hunt flies, right? Hunt elephants. Make sure you've got agreement on the roles that people are going to play, and the process you're going to follow before you worry about relationships, and understand how you're going to maintain shared situational awareness. What do we do? Why am I giving this talk? We actually work with a lot of experts in different fields. We have to get rapidly up to speed to make this happen. In particular, our focus is new technology introduction, new market creation, and early customers, early revenue. A lot of times we're looking at how can we identify a niche, how can we segment a market so that this offering can stand on its own against an incumbent? Is there an underserved area or an overserved area we can target? How do you price to value? And finally, how do you actually plan the sequence of negotiations you've got to go through in an orchestrated sale to get the business? Right? Most large companies, it's not like you show up and you say, can I have your credit card, and you give them a piece of software. There's a committee process. Thanks for all your time. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Don't forget, please fill these out.
So you fill these